Chapter 11. One night when he was in India, the spirit of adventure came upon Benham. He had gone with Keppel, of the forestry department, into the jungle country in the hills above the Tapti. He had been very anxious to see something of that aspect of Indian life, and he had snatched at the chance Keppel had given him. But they had scarcely started before the expedition was brought to an end by an accident. Keppel was thrown by a pony and his ankle broken. He and Benham bandaged it as well as they could, and a litter was sent for, and meanwhile they had to wait in the camp that was to have been the center of their jungle raids. The second day of this waiting was worse for Keppel than the first, and he suffered much from the pressure of this amateurish bandaging. In the evening Benham got cool water from the well, and rearranged things better. The two men dined and smoked under their thatched roof beneath the big banyan, and then Keppel, tired out by his day of pain, was carried to his tent. Presently he fell asleep, and Benham was left to himself. Now that the heat was over, he found himself quite indisposed to sleep. He felt full of life and anxious for happenings. He went back and sat down upon the iron bedstead beneath the banyan that Keppel had lain upon through the day, and he watched the soft immensity of the Indian night swallow up the last lingering colors of the world. It left the outlines, it obliterated nothing, but it stripped off the superficial reality of things. The moon was full and high overhead, and the light had not so much gone as changed from definition, and the blazing glitter and reflections of solidity to a translucent and unsubstantial clearness. The jungle that bordered the little encampment north, south, and west seemed to have crept a little nearer, enriched itself with blackness, taken to itself voices. Surely it had been silent during the day. A warm, faintly scented breeze just stirred the dead grass and the leaves. In the day the air had been still. Immediately after the sunset there had been a great crying of peacocks in the distance, but that was over now. The crickets, however, were still noisy, and a persistent sound had become predominant, an industrious unmistakable sound, a sound that took his mind back to England, in midsummer. It was like a watchman's rattle, a nightjar. So there were nightjars here in India too. One might have expected something less familiar. And then came another cry from far away over the heat-stripped treetops, a less familiar cry. It was repeated. Was that perhaps some craving leopard, a tiger cat, a panther? Hunt, hunt, that might be a deer. Then suddenly an angry chattering came from the dark trees quite close at hand. A monkey? These great, scarce visible, sweeping movements through the air were bats, of course. The day jungle is the jungle asleep. This was its waking hour. Now the deer were arising from their forms, the bears creeping out of their dens amidst the rocks and blundering down the gullies, the tigers and panthers and jungle cats stalking noiselessly from their lairs in the grass. Countless creatures that had hidden from the heat and pitiless exposure of the day stood now awake and alertly intent upon their purposes, grazed or sought water, flitting delicately through the moonlight and shadows. The jungle was awakening. Again Benham heard that sound like the belling of a stag. This was the real life of the jungle, this night life, into which man did not go. Here he was on the verge of a world that for all the stuffed trophies of the sportsman and the specimens of the naturalist is still almost as unknown as if it was upon another planet. What intruders men are, what foreigners in the life of this ancient system. He looked over his shoulder, and there were the two little tents, one that sheltered Keppel and one that awaited him, and beyond, in an irregular line, glowed the ruddy smoky fires of the men. One or two turbaned figures still flitted about, and there was a voice, low, monotonous, it must have been telling a tale. Further, sighing and stirring ever and again, were tethered beasts, and then a great pale space of moonlight, and the clumsy outlines of the village well. The clustering village itself slept in darkness beyond the mango trees, and still remoter the black encircling jungle closed in. One might have fancied this was the encampment of newly come invaders, were it not for the larger villages that are overgrown with thickets and altogether swallowed up again in the wilderness, and for the deserted temples that are found rent asunder by the roots of trees and the ancient embankments that hold water only for the drinking of the Sambar deer. Benham turned his face to the dim jungle again. He had come far out of his way to visit this strange world of the ancient life that now recedes and dwindles before our new civilization, that seems fated to shrivel up and pass altogether before the dry advance of physical science and material organization. He was full of unsatisfied curiosities about its fierce hungers and passions, its fears and cruelties, its instincts and its well-nigh incommunicable and yet most precious understandings. He had long ceased to believe that the wild beast is wholly evil, and safety and plenty the ultimate good for man. Perhaps he would never get nearer to this mysterious jungle life than he was now. It was intolerably tantalizing that it should be so close at hand, and so inaccessible. As Benham sat brooding over his disappointment, the moon, swimming on through the still circle of the hours, passed slowly over him. The lights and shadows about him changed by imperceptible gradations, and a long pale alley, where the native cart track drove into the forest, opened slowly out of the darkness, slowly broadened, slowly lengthened. It opened out to him with a quality of invitation. There was the jungle before him. Was it after all so inaccessible? "Come," the road said to him. Benham rose and walked out a few paces into the moonlight and stood motionless. Was he afraid? Even now some hungry watchful monster might lurk in yonder shadows, watching with infinite still patience. Keppel had told him how they would sit still for hours, staring unblinkingly as cats stare at a fire, and then crouch to advance. Beneath the shrill overtone of the night jars, what noiseless gray shapes, what deep breathings and cracklings and creepings might there not be? Dot, was he afraid? That question determined him to go. He hesitated whether he should take a gun. A stick? A gun, he knew, was a dangerous thing to an inexperienced man. No. He would go now, even as he was with empty hands. At least he would go as far as the end of that band of moonlight. If for no other reason than because he was afraid. Now. For a moment it seemed to him as though his feet were too heavy to lift, and then, hands in pockets, khaki clad, an almost invisible figure, he strolled towards the cart track. Come to that, he halted for a moment to regard the distant fires of the men. No one would miss him. They would think he was in his tent. He faced the stirring quiet ahead. The cart track was a rutted path of soft, warm sand, on which he went almost noiselessly. A bird squabbled for an instant in a thicket. A great white owl floated like a flake of moonlight across the track, and vanished without a sound among the trees. Along the moonlit path went Benham, and when he passed near trees his footsteps became noisy with the rustle and crash of dead leaves. The jungle was full of moonlight. Twigs, branches, creepers, grass clumps came out acutely vivid. The trees and bushes stood in pools of darkness, and beyond were pale stretches of misty moonshine, and big rocks shining with an unearthly luster. Things seemed to be clear and yet uncertain. It was as if they dissolved or retired a little, and then returned to solidity. A sudden shattering broke out overhead, and black across the great stars, soared a flying squirrel, and caught a twig, and ran for shelter. A second hesitated in a treetop and pursued. They chased each other and vanished abruptly. He forgot his sense of insecurity in the interest of these active little silhouettes. And he noted how much bigger and more wonderful the stars can look when one sees them through interlacing branches. Ahead was darkness, but not so dark, when he came to it, that the track was invisible. He was at the limit of his intention, but now he saw that that had been a childish project. He would go on, he would walk right into the jungle. his first disinclination was conquered, and the soft intoxication of the subtropical moonshine was in his blood, but he wished he could walk as a spirit walks, without this noise of leaves. Yes, this was very wonderful and beautiful, and there must always be jungles for men to walk in. Always there must be jungles, some small beast snarled and bolted from under his feet. He stopped sharply. He had come into a darkness under great boughs, and now he stood still as the little creature scuttled away. Beyond the track emerged into a dazzling whiteness, in the stillness he could hear the deer belling again in the distance, and then came a fuss of monkeys in a group of trees near at hand. He remained still until this had died away into mutterings. Then on the verge of movement he was startled by a ripe mango that slipped from its stalk, and fell out of the tree, and struck his hand. It took a little time to understand that, and then he laughed, and his muscles relaxed, and he went on again. A thorn caught at him, and he disentangled himself. He crossed the open space, and the moon was like a great shield of light spread out above him. All the world seemed swimming in its radiance. The stars were like lamps in a mist of silvery blue. The track led him on across wide open spaces of shriveled grass and sand, amidst trees where shadows made black patternings upon the silver, and then it plunged into obscurities. For a time it lifted, and then on one hand the bush fell away, and he saw across a vast moonlit valley wide undulations of open cultivation, belts of jungle, copses, and a great lake as black as ebony. For a time the path ran thus open, and then the jungle closed in again, and there were more thickets, more levels of grass, and in one place far overhead among the branches he heard, and stood for a time perplexed at a vast deep humming of bees. Presently a black monster with a hunched back went across his path heedless of him, and making a great noise in the leaves. He stood quite still until it had gone. He could not tell whether it was a boar or hyena. Most probably, he thought, a boar because of the heaviness of its rush. The path dropped downhill for a time, crossed a ravine, ascended. He passed a great leafless tree on which there were white flowers. On the ground also, in the darkness under the tree, there were these flowers. They were dropping noiselessly, and since they were visible in the shadows, it seemed to him that they must be phosphorescent. And they emitted a sweetish scent that lay heavily athwart the path. Presently he passed another such tree. Then he became aware of a tumult ahead of him, a smashing of leaves, a snorting and slobbering, grunting and sucking, a whole series of bestial sounds. He halted for a little while, and then drew nearer, picking his steps to avoid too great a noise. Here were more of those white blossom trees, and beneath, in the darkness, something very black and big was going to and fro, eating greedily. Then he found that there were two, and then more of these black things, three or four of them. Curiosity made Benham draw nearer, very softly. Presently one showed in a patch of moonlight, startlingly big, a huge, black hairy monster with a long white nose on a grotesque face, and he was stuffing armfuls of white blossom into his mouth with his curved fore claws. He took not the slightest notice of the still man, who stood perhaps 20 yards away from him. He was too blind and careless. He snorted and smacked his slobbering lips, and plunged into the shadows again. Benham heard him root among the leaves and grunt appreciatively. The air was heavy with the reek of the crushed flowers. For some time Benham remained listening to, and peering at these preoccupied gluttons. At last he shrugged his shoulders, and left them, and went on his way. For a long time he could hear them, then just as he was on the verge of forgetting them altogether, some dispute arose among them, and there began a vast uproar, squeals, protests, comments, one voice ridiculously replete and authoritative, ridiculously suggestive of a drunken judge with his mouth full, and a shrill voice of grievance high above the others. The uproar of the bears died away at last, almost abruptly, and left the jungle to the incessant night jars. For what end was this life of the jungle? All Benham's senses were alert to the sounds and appearances about him, and at the same time his mind was busy with the perplexities of that riddle. Was the jungle just an aimless pool of life that man must drain and clear away? Or is it to have a use in the greater life of our race that now begins? Will man value the jungle as he values the precipice, for the sake of his manhood? Will he preserve it? Man must keep hard. Man must also keep fierce. Will the jungle keep him fierce? For life, thought Benham, there must be insecurity. He had missed the track. He was now in a second ravine. He was going downward, walking on silvery sand amidst great boulders, and now there was a new sound in the air. It was the croaking of frogs. Ahead was a solitary gleam. He was approaching a jungle pool. Suddenly the stillness was alive, in a panic uproar. Ankh! Cried a great voice, and ankh! There was a clatter of hoofs, a wild rush, a rush as it seemed towards him. Was he being charged? He backed against a rock. A great pale shape leaped by him, an antlered shape. It was a herd of big deer bolting suddenly out of the stillness. He heard the swish and smash of their retreat grow distant, disperse. He remained standing with his back to the rock. Slowly the strophe, and anti-strophe of frogs and goat suckers resumed possession of his consciousness. But now some primitive instinct, perhaps, or some subconscious intimation of danger made him meticulously noiseless. He went on down a winding sound-deadening path of sand towards the drinking place. He came to a wide white place that was almost level, and beyond it under clustering pale-stemmed trees shone the mirror surface of some ancient tank, and, sharp and black, a dog-like beast sat on its tail in the midst of this space, started convulsively and went slinking into the undergrowth. Benham paused for a moment, and then walked out softly into the light, and, behold, as if it were to meet him, came a monster, a vast dark shape drawing itself lengthily out of the blackness, and stopped with a start, as if it had been instantly changed to stone. It had stopped with one paw advanced. Its striped mask was light, a dark gray in the moonlight, gray but faintly tinged with ruddiness. Its mouth was a little open, its fangs and a pendant of viscous saliva shone vivid. Its great round pupilled eyes regarded him steadfastly. At last the nightmare of Benham's childhood had come true, and he was face to face with a tiger, uncaged, uncontrolled. For some moments neither moved, neither the beast nor the man. They stood face to face, each perhaps with an equal astonishment, motionless and soundless, in that mad Indian moonlight that makes all things like a dream. Benham stood quite motionless, and body and mind had halted together. That confrontation had an interminableness that had nothing to do with the actual passage of time. Then some trickle of his previous thoughts stirred in the frozen quiet of his mind. He spoke hoarsely. "A man," he said, and lifted a hand as he spoke. He thought of the world. His heart leapt within him as the tiger moved. But the great beast went sideways, guarded, only that its head was low, three noiseless instantaneous strides it made, and stood again watching him. "Man," he said, in a voice that had no sound, and took a step forward. Whoa! With two bounds the monster had become a great gray streak that crackled and rustled in the shadows of the trees. And then it had vanished, become invisible and inaudible with a kind of instantaneousness. For some seconds or some minutes Benham stood rigid, fearlessly expectant, and then far away up the ravine he heard the deer repeat their cry of alarm, and understood with a new wisdom that the tiger had passed among them, and was gone. He walked on towards the deserted tank, and now he was talking aloud. "I understand the jungle. I understand if a few men die here, what matter? There are worse deaths than being killed. What is this fool's trap of security? Every time in my life that I have fled from security, I have fled from death. Let men stew in their cities if they will. It is in the lonely places, in jungles and mountains, in snows and fires, in the still observatories and the silent laboratories, in those secret and dangerous places, where life probes into life. It is there that the masters of the world, the lords of the beast, the rebel sons of fate come to their own, you sleeping away there in the cities. Do you know what it means for you, that I am here tonight? Do you know what it means to you? I am just one, just the precursor. Presently, if you will not budge, those hot cities must be burned about you. You must come out of them. He wandered now, uttering his thoughts as they came to him, and he saw no more living creatures, because they fled and hid before the sound of his voice. He wandered until the moon, larger now and yellow-tinged, was low between the black bars of the tree stems. And then it sank very suddenly behind a hilly spur and the light failed swiftly. He stumbled and went with difficulty. He could go no further among these rocks and ravines, and he sat down at the foot of a tree to wait for day. He sat very still indeed. A great stillness came over the world, a velvet silence that wrapped about him, as the velvet shadows wrapped about him. The corncrakes had ceased, all the sounds and stir of animal life had died away, the breeze had fallen. A drowsing comfort took possession of him. He grew more placid, and more placid still. He was enormously content to find that fear had fled before him and was gone. He drifted into that state of mind, when one thinks without ideas, when one's mind is like a starless sky, serene and empty. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.